Ukraine says more Russian missiles struck the city of Dnipro, hitting a military barracks and killing members of its National Guard.
What we know so far is that there were three Iskander missiles which were fired from the area of Russian Federation from Rostov region.
Plus, what happened to Russian President Vladimir Putin's early military strategy to quickly assume control over Ukraine?
War is a test of logistics, and it's a test of will. And it's clear that Ukrainian soldiers and the Ukrainian population have the superior will.
And later in the program, how thousands of Russian IT professionals are opposing Moscow's war of aggression. Today is Friday, May 27th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian forces in northeastern Ukraine, already pushed back to near the Russian border, appear to be launching a new counteroffensive as the three-month-old war morphs into what some Western officials describe as a scrap with no end in sight. In the Dnipro region, Ukrainian officials say that a Russian missile hit a Ukrainian National Guard barracks, resulting in at least 10 fatalities and more than 30 people being wounded. Earlier today, I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to learn more about what's known about these latest series of attacks.
Today, Dnipro region was under very massive attack. It happened around 3-4 a.m. in the morning. What we know so far is that there were three Iskander missiles which were fired from the area of Russian Federation from Rostov region. And one of those three Iskander missiles reached the target. The attack was targeted for the barrack of the National Guard of Ukraine. And according to the officials, there are killed and injured people. We don't know for the moment regarding the final, damages, but there are quite a lot of damages. And just to mention that Dnipro region for the moment is one of the center and main regions for all the refugees from Donbas area and Kharkiv region. So this area and this region concentrates a very, very big amount of civilians.
And I also want to ask you about the fighting that's taking place in other regions throughout the northeast and south of Ukraine. Can you give us a quick update, please?
So the main direction of Russian attack for the moment is the city of Severodonetsk. And it's very important for Russian forces to take it over and to control it, because this would give them almost full control of the Luhansk region. And for the moment, the city of Severodonetsk is basically the main and the worst battlefield along the whole front line. The reason for that is that Ukrainian forces still can keep and they still can defend this area, and they are doing this as much as they can. But of course, they need supplies and they need more equipment. And this is what Ukraine and Ukrainian government is saying all the time. And Ukrainian government is waiting for this equipment. So Ukrainian army is waiting for new equipment to come into to stop Russian forces from this push in Luhansk region. If we talk about north and south, also situation seems to escalate. But for the moment, according to the general staff and according to the Ukrainian intelligence, that there are training sessions by Russian forces in the north border with Ukraine. So, and there are intensifying attacks, the shelling from the territory of Russian Federation of the area regions in the north of Ukraine, like Sumy and Chernihiv. But for the moment, there are no particular signs of breakage of the border or another or new attack or new intervention into the territory.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about Mariupol. According to some reports, the mayor there has released grim figures of additional civilians that have been found to have been killed. What exactly has been shared? And I guess, how is the mayor coming about this information, because Russia now controls that portion of the country?
We know that this information is coming mostly from the intelligence and from the civilians who are there, who tell this, well, apparently to Ukrainian officials who still have connection with certain people. And according to the officials, today it was another, well, shocking news that another 70 bodies of the civilians, they were found under the ruins of former October plant. And this plant was one of the shelters for the civilians.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv. Anna, thank you for all your reporting this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Turkey's foreign minister says that both Sweden and Finland must take concrete steps to alleviate his country's security concerns in order to overcome Ankara's objections to their NATO membership bid. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said on Friday that delegations from the two Nordic countries have returned home with Turkey's demands after a visit this week, and Ankara is awaiting their answers. The country's membership bids require support from all NATO countries, but Turkey is objecting to them. Turkey cited alleged support for Kurdish militants that Turkey considers terrorists and restrictions on weapon sales to Turkey. Earlier, Russia denounced recently imposed U.S. and European sanctions while seeking to blame the West for a growing international food crisis. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has that story.
With its war on Ukraine nearing a fourth month, Russia pressed for a lifting of sanctions imposed by the West Thursday and also said a growing international food crisis has been exacerbated by Ukraine's inability to ship millions of tons of grain and other agricultural products. The Russian statement ignored its own blockade of Ukraine's ports, many of which are also now heavily mined. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss accused Russia of trying to hold the world to ransom. At the Pentagon, spokesman John Kirby agreed.
They're weaponizing food. They're weaponizing economic assistance.
The director general of the World Trade Organization said about 25 million tons of Ukrainian grain is in storage, and another 25 million tons could be harvested next month. I'm Mike Gracia.
The Kremlin said on Friday that it blames Ukraine for the fact that peace talks between the two countries are frozen. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said in a call to reporters, quote, "The Ukrainian leadership constantly makes contradictory statements. This does not allow us to fully understand what the Ukrainian said wants," end quote. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said on multiple occasions that he has tried organizing meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the war, but that the Russian side did not appear to be ready yet for serious peace talks. Now, at the war's onset, Russian officials said that their goal was to demilitarize and, in their description, denazify Ukraine. Oleksiy Kolonenko looks at what happened to that strategy.
In the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Western analysts predicted Russia's military would quickly take control of Ukraine and its capital city, Kyiv. 3 months later, it's clear the Russian army has done significant damage.
They have seized territory, and they have they're putting tremendous damage on Ukraine's economy. They're blocking the export of grain.
Still, Western military experts say the Russian campaign has been a failure.
I mean, they have fallen short on every objective. The Ministry of Defense has been exposed as a corrupt institution, and that their soldiers are murderers. They use weapons indiscriminately against civilian targets.
General Ben Hodges, the former U.S. commander in Europe, says Russia did not account for the fierce will of the Ukrainian people.
War is a test of logistics, and it's a test of will. And it's clear that Ukrainian soldiers and Ukrainian population have the superior will because they're fighting for their home. They're fighting to defend their families, literally. Whereas Russia is the aggressor, the invader. These soldiers, the Russian soldiers that are being used as cannon fodder, terribly because their own leadership doesn't care about them.
Ukrainian resistance has forced the Russians to change their initial strategy of a quick blitzkrieg type invasion into slower, deadlier, and more damaging form of warfare.
They're trying to build up a huge amount of mass of forces, and they're just very slowly, very inefficiently, and very destructively crawling forward into Ukrainian space, destroying everything, which actually is in some ways consistent with what Russia has done in Grozny, in Syria, in Donbass and Crimea, which is basically they grind down the area, grind down the enemy.
Jan Dzerzhinsky from the Atlantic Council says this new strategy will require a long-term commitment from the Western allies to continue sanctions against Russia and provide material and logistical help to Ukraine.
It's almost kind of a long-term game of attrition, in which what will be key is sustaining Ukrainian confidence and will. That can be done, importantly, through sustaining Western assistance to Ukraine, ramping up, you know, continuing to ramp up the flow of military supplies.
Hodges predicts the attack will last until the fall and that Ukrainian forces will recapture what the Russians have taken.
So end of August, first part of September, Russian forces will collapse and Ukraine, hopefully, will have built up enough offensive capability to launch a counterattack to push the Russians back to at least the 23 February line. I think that happens by September.
But rebuilding Ukraine is daunting prospect the country must still face. The World Bank says the war has caused more than $60 billion worth of damage to buildings and infrastructure in Ukraine and displaced more than 12 million people. Alexei Kovalenko, VOA News, Washington.
A Ukrainian court sentenced Russian soldier Vadim Shishimarin to life in prison this week for the shooting death of Ukrainian national Alexander Shilipov in the first war crimes trial arising from the invasion. With the trial now over, Shilipov's widow, Katerina, is trying to come to terms with her loss. Reuters' Louisa Knox brings us her story.
Photographs and memories are what Katerina Shilipova has left to remember her husband of 36 years. 62-year-old Oleksandr Shilipov was shot dead on February the 28th in Chikhovka, located in Ukraine's northeast, 4 days after Russian forces invaded. The man convicted for his death, 21-year-old tank commander Vadim Shishimarin, was sentenced to life in prison on Monday in the first war crimes trial arising from the invasion. During his trial, he had asked for Katerina to forgive him. On the day her husband died, she said she had heard gunshots while she was in her yard. After looking out, she says she saw Shishimarin holding an automatic rifle.
When I left the yard, I didn't see him immediately. But when I went further out, I looked here and I saw him lying here. Shot, straight in the head.
Katerina still has the bicycle her husband was riding when he was killed. Shishimarin had pled guilty to killing the unarmed Shilipov. Ukrainian state prosecutors said he had been ordered to shoot at him from a car. Shilipov's killing was one of what Ukraine and Western nations say is a far wider picture. Ukraine has accused Russia of atrocities and brutality against civilians during the invasion, and said it has identified more than 10,000 possible war crimes. Russia has denied targeting civilians or involvement in war crimes in what it calls a special operation. Shilipov's killing has shaken the entire community in Chupachivka, including his friend Mykola Radkov.
I could tell you a lot of things, but I can't. It hurts very much, very much. I still can't believe that he's not alive. I still think that he's here, that he'll come here and say, good day, or hello, that he says this.
Despite Shishimarin's imprisonment, Mykola is unable to come to terms with the loss of his friend.
That's how it is, guys. It hurts. It hurts and hurts. That's it.
Louisa Knox of Reuters News. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The resignation earlier this week of veteran Russian diplomat Boris Bondarev over the invasion of Ukraine was an embarrassment for the Kremlin. But analysts say fear prevents most Russian officials from voicing dissent. Henry Ridgewell is up next.
41-year-old Boris Bondarev forged a 20-year career in the Russian diplomatic service. Until this week, he worked at the United Nations in Geneva. He confirmed his resignation Monday in a letter posted on Facebook, saying, "Never have I been so ashamed of my country as on February the 24th of this year, the date Russia launched its latest invasion of Ukraine."
Of course, the war in Ukraine is a pivotal moment, because when there is no choice after that. There is only one choice, is to leave, to quit. Don't know for now what I'm going to do next. I'm thinking about it, yeah, but I think if I have to go back to Russia, then the prospects may be not very, very pleasant.
The resignation will be embarrassing for the Kremlin, says Valery Solovey, a former professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations, where he taught several of Russia's diplomats.
Because the Kremlin was absolutely sure in loyalty of the Russian Foreign Office. I think that Bondarev reflects a general emotion of many of his colleagues in the Foreign Office. But it does mean that they are ready to follow him.
Solovey says Moscow has since conducted an urgent review of its diplomatic staff.
There will be more control outside the country, and maybe some who are in the list, were included in the list as potentially disloyal, will be removed from their embassies outside the country to Moscow.
The Kremlin will not be panicking, says analyst Alex Titov.
I wouldn't expect them to have, mass resignations.
Most officials remained loyal to President Vladimir Putin, says Titov.
Diplomats are, a special caste in a sense. They are selected for, they use their loyalty in many ways. They also have a lot of benefits. They are kind of these professionals which attuned to this idea of a hostility with the West.
The Kremlin has one method to ensure loyalty, says Solovey.
Fear and strong control.
Bondarev said he is fearful for his safety. Under Putin's rule, several dissidents living overseas have been killed or targeted by the Russian state, although Moscow denies such actions. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, thousands of Russian citizens, the majority of them working in the IT sector and passionately opposing Russia's aggression, have moved to Armenia. Anna Rice narrates that story.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, only about 3,000 to 4,000 Russians were registered in Armenia as workers, according to local authorities. But this changed after the invasion. In just the first 2 weeks of the invasion of Ukraine, about 3,000 to 4,000 Russians arrived in Armenia each day. And while many continue their journey to other countries, a significant number of Russians stay in Armenia. Some of them are here as a form of protest against Russia's actions in Ukraine. Many of them are unwilling to talk about the invasion for fear the government might retaliate against their relatives back in Russia. But Yevgeny is a Russian citizen with Ukrainian roots. He says he just can't understand what is happening in Ukraine.
Сложно было представить, что в 21 веке люди снова будут делать это.
It's difficult to imagine that in the 21st century people would still do something like this. The methods remain the same. It's difficult to imagine that instead of trying to reach an agreement, people are still being killed. It's strange. It's just stupid.
He came to Armenia so he could continue his work with international clients. He says sanctions are making it impossible to work in Moscow.
I've worked with foreign clients for the last 8 years, but we lost the opportunity to work because of Russia. All big employers from abroad closed our accounts and directly told us they want to work with us, but only if we went somewhere else and opened accounts in those countries. Coming to Armenia was convenient in every way.
Yevgeny says things are a bit challenging, but that he enjoys Armenia.
The rent prices have gone up, but it's fair since many people have moved here from Russia. Everything else here is accessible. The food is delicious and cheap, and there's internet. It's warm here in every sense. People support you and try to help in every way, as much as they can. There's no such thing in Russia.
Просто подходят на улицы и спрашивают, чем помочь.
Every week, the number of Russians in Armenia grows as whole offices relocate. Russians can stay in Armenia freely for up to 6 months, after which they need to leave the country. Like many here, this Russian did not want us to use his real name.
Soon, I'll go back to Russia. I just came here to see Armenia. Even with the naked eye, you can see that there are so many Russians here. When we came here last year, there were no traffic jams on our way. But this time, there were so many.
For many Russians, moving to Armenia is a way to keep working, show support for Ukraine, or avoid being drafted if the war drags on. Most hope the invasion will end soon, but few believe things will ever be the same. For Shake Avayan in Yerevan, Armenia, NRI's VOA News.
After the government of Belarus cracked down on protesters following the 2020 presidential elections, some 200,000 to 300,000 people fled Belarus, ending up as refugees in Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, and a number of other EU countries. Now they're helping Ukrainian refugees and Belarusians who are being forced to move yet again. Maxim Moskakolov rounds us out.
Oksana Bukina was arrested in 2020 during a protest in Belarus. Later, a criminal case was opened accusing her of causing civil unrest. She managed to flee to Ukraine together with her young son. From there, she moved to Poland. She knows what it is to be a refugee, so when the war in Ukraine started, she began volunteering to assist refugees with accommodation, money and food, among other things. Dozens of other volunteers came to help too.
Emotionally, it's very tough to greet people and not lose composure. I mean, who are we greeting? Women with children, elderly people, many are quite sick.
Many of the volunteers here fled Belarus after the harsh crackdown on protesters in 2020. Now they are helping Ukrainians under assault from Russia.
The volunteer movement of Belarusians abroad is focused on a number of spheres: raising funds, collecting humanitarian aid, medications, and collecting personal equipment for those Belarusians who are volunteering in Ukraine's armed forces, as well as for Ukrainian soldiers.
A Belarusian youth hub in downtown Warsaw is a cultural and educational space that has become home to over 24 various initiatives. Alexander Lapko, who is heading the hub, says his team is trying to help all refugees from Ukraine, but keeping a special eye out for Belarusians.
All sorts of people come to us. Belarusians, Ukrainians, people with other citizenships. We even had Syrians and Turks. But our main focus is on helping Belarusians who are fleeing Ukraine. There are many people for whom it's the second time they've become refugees. First, they fled the Lukashenko regime to go to Ukraine. And now, they're forced to leave Ukraine to come to Poland.
The Belarusian Solidarity Center in Warsaw is another space where Ukrainian refugees can come and receive help.
We rented a hostel specifically for Ukrainian refugees, so that we can accommodate more people. Since the start of the war, we have already found homes for over 300 refugees.
The center is also providing legal services and psychological assistance for those who need them. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with even more coverage on our website. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.